This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Jay Hanselman, filling in today for Dan Hurley. Hamilton County and the Cincinnati Bengals disagree on the location of a proposed music venue at the banks. Cincinnati and the county are in a dispute about water rates. At the same time, a deal reached last year to transform the Metropolitan Sewer District now appears to be in jeopardy. And why is the county having budget problems? Joining us to discuss those issues are Cincinnati Inquirer regional government reporter Scott Wortman, Cincinnati Business Courier staff reporter and columnist Chris Wetterich, and WVXU reporter Bill Reinhart. You can join our conversation. The phone number is 513-419-7100. You can email talk at WVXU.org. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. Again, 513-419-7100. Thank you all for being here.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you. Fasten your seatbelts. We have a lot to cover here this afternoon.
Let's do it.
Let's start with you, Scott, and the music venue. Back in June, I believe it was, Cincinnati Council and the Hamilton County Commission selected the Cincinnati Symphony Mimi proposal to be the preferred plan to move forward with that. And since then, we haven't heard a lot about it. There was a meeting this week, so bring us up to date on where we are in this, process.
It's kind of interesting. It was such an imperative in May, and then it's kind of ground to a halt. And it's because a lot of people have to get on board for this, the city, the county, and the Bengals. The big issue is where exactly it's going to go on the riverfront. Because of the lease that the county gave the Bengals 20 years ago, the Bengals have a lot of rights. They have veto power within a block of Paul Brown, which is where the music venue wants to go. So it's a matter of the county and the Bengals coming to an agreement, and that's what we're waiting on right now. The commissioners earlier this week, time is blurring together for me.
It's okay.
They expressed unanimously, all three commissioners, that they want it where the Bengals don't want it, which is right alongside Paul Brown Stadium. So we're probably going to be in for a fight and some horse trading between the Bengals and the county this fall.
And where the county wants it are basically, I think, like just a series of parking lots.
Yes.
Right now.
Yeah, the Bengals, the reason they don't want it there, they want to keep that for tailgating. And in their defense, that is the largest single lot that the Bengals have for Paul Brown Stadium. And when they hammered out that agreement to build the stadium 20 years ago, Mike Brown wanted to be closer to the suspension bridge, so that was all part of the compromise that, well, if we're going to go down here, then you can't build anything that's going to obstruct our view.
What and the Bengals are pushing, I believe, what is Lot 24, which is directly south of the Freedom Center?
Yes, it's a parking garage right now, which it'd be on top of the parking garage. But the problem with that is it's the largest undeveloped parcel on the banks, and a developer has already proposed a $75 million residential and commercial development there. That's not a done deal in and of itself, but the commissioners would rather have that be a much bigger development than a music venue.
Chris, what do you make of all this?
It's such a poor usage of that lot to consider putting the music venue there. It's clearly it's a large lot. It's the garage is already built that you would need to raise it out of the floodplain. It should totally be a non-starter for both the city and the county to put the music venue there. The Bengals say they want those lots for tailgating adjacent to the stadium, which is where the county wants to put the music venue. You know, I've been trying to figure out for some weeks, and some elected officials, including Councilmember Seelbach, brought this up, that, you know, the tailgating, the open drinking in the parking lots there is not exactly legal. I asked the city police department some months ago whether they considered that legal or illegal. I didn't get any response to that question, so I'm kind of curious. I know that it's probably not an enforcement priority, but I think it does show that the city and the county have some leverage over the Bengals there as well. I mean, if everybody wants to sit out there drinking Shirley Temples, maybe they'll get to keep that lot for tailgating. But, you know, I think that the city and the county have some leverage.
The issue, though, is the county gave the Bengals this right 20 years ago, so there really isn't a legal leg for the county or the city to stand on. If they persist and the Bengals don't agree, then the Bengals can take them to court. And, I mean, it was part of the agreement that all the leaders agreed to 20 years ago.
Let's break down a couple things. Let's go back to the tailgating. And I remember that Councilmember Seelbach was was adamant about the tailgating. If you're drinking there, it's illegal. The city has certainly been enforcing the whether you can camp or not.
It sure has, hasn't
parking
it?
Lot. Is that going to
bring the epitome of white privilege, isn't it?
Is that going to bring new concentration on, you know, maybe you were able to tailgate there last year with your alcohol, but, you know, maybe this year the police may take a different look at that?
I don't know, and it's a question I've asked and haven't really got an answer to. So, I don't know whether there'll be some political pressure from people who are kind of tired of being pushed around by the Bengals to kind of ratchet up the pressure on them to, you know, really take a solution that would really benefit the whole region here.
You have I just lost your name.
Scott. I have one of those
Chris.
Faces.
I was trying. It's Scott. Yeah, that's it, Scott. Clearly, the county has been in this situation with the Bengals before when they built the office tower for General
yes.
Electric. The Bengals had to sign off. They did sign off to allow that to be higher. But in return for that, they got some compensations for the county to spend, was it like $16 million for some improvements to Paul Brown Stadium?
The Bengals did clarify they did pay for some of that, so it was $10 million to the county. But yeah, the county paid for a new scoreboard and Wi-Fi and a few other improvements. And in return, the Bengals relaxed the height restrictions to allow the GE headquarters to be built.
If that has to happen this time, can the county afford to do that?
Well, the way they're talking, no. I mean, they got a $29 million deficit coming up, and this would just be added on top of that.
Chris, what do you see the end game of this?
You know, it feels like to me the county commissioners are, you know, they could have capitulated, you know, pretty easily here, but it sounds like they're kind of drawing a line in the sand. And you know, I don't have a good sense as to what's going on behind the scenes right now, what kind of discussion. So I've asked the Bengals a number of questions about this and just kind of got a perfunctory no comment to all of those questions. So I don't have a good sense as to where they are, and I'm sure they don't want to reveal their negotiating position.
Mike Brown, the one insight that we did get was they throw for the sports writers a mock turtle soup luncheon. And
Yum.
He did address.
They've had the same menu apparently for, what, 20 or 30 years?
Tradition, I guess. But he reiterated that, you know, no, we want that parking lot preserved and we're not budging. So it doesn't sound like at this point, I'm sure they will, but they will relent, but it will cost the county or somebody something.
Now, Bill Reinhart can jump in when I say this, that I've been labeled as negative, cynical, and pessimistic.
Yes, I will confirm that.
But, I mean, you keep hearing the county officials saying, well, we can still have this done by next fall, but I don't see any way.
No.
If they wanted this done next fall, they probably needed to be under construction last fall.
Right.
Which is what they said earlier this year, that, you know, should be under – it is almost September.
Let's also not forget the city's role in this. They need a garage above that, which the city kind of helps, you know, sign off on and whatnot. And, you know, we haven't heard from the mayor yet where he stands. I've asked City Hall that question as well and not really gotten a response about that either. So,
and I think the city's position now is that since there is really no master developer for the banks at this point, basically anything that they've done to this point to build garages, they think that that's all subject to renegotiation.
Right. The future garages, I think the mayor feels that the city has gotten an unfair deal in that it lets all of that revenue go to the county. And, you know, the flip side was, well, the city will get income taxes from businesses that locate there. But when GE located there, it abated most of the income taxes. I mean, you could say, well, that's on you guys for doing that. But that's kind of the reality of economic development in this country today. So I think that he wants a renegotiation there. And the other part of this is you need a park for part of this music venue. Last time we checked or heard about it, they don't have the money for that either.
Scott, you had a story today that the music venue is also tied now to the Midpoint Music Festival, and it's on hold
yes.
until this venue issue is settled.
Well, this is kind of a result of now the CSO and their music management, or Mimi, pretty much control and own all the venues downtown, including this new venue, and they own Midpoint now for the last, since 2016. And they had moved it around to a parking lot in 2016, then back to the Taft. And now they're just going to hold off until they build this music venue. which could be at the earliest next year, but probably 2 years off. So we won't have midpoint anymore until then.
I talked to Memmi about this midpoint issue as well as tall stacks back in June. And while they told me that midpoint was on hiatus was the word that they used back then, they also said that they'd look at bringing back tall stacks at some point if they got this music venue. So they already have it. Basically, they've been told they're the preferred developer for it. But I thought that was an interesting wrinkle as
well. I've always wondered with that because there aren't really many steamboats left in existence. A lot of them been scrapped. I don't know how.
Well, I think it started out as tall stacks and then it kind of generated we'll have a couple of steamboats and a lot of music to go with it.
Yeah, I think the boats are less of an emphasis. The last time they had tall stacks, they had Wilco playing on, I think, Sawyer Point. So this would be a little bit more central venue for them.
513-419-7100 if you have a question or comment. Rod, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to ask a question. I'm not up on this exactly, but it was my recollection that taxpayers built the stadium, paid for the stadium, not necessarily the Bengals. And if so, wouldn't the taxpayers have the ultimate say about whether there should be a music venue there or not?
No, because they signed away some of the rights to some of the land around, not the rights, but they put restrictions on the right on what can be built around the stadium, really adjacent to it. So I believe, Scott, correct me if I'm wrong, I think they can only go two stories high, right? Yes. Next to Paul Brown Stadium. Is that right?
Within a block of the stadium,
right,
yes.
Right, within a block of the stadium.
I mean, that's definitely a very valid question and point, but the bottom line is the contract says that they can't, and that was what was agreed to at the time.
Rod, we appreciate your call. We don't want Bill to go to sleep here in the studio.
What?
So you can tell us about today's announcement at the Banks involving a temporary attraction that's going to be at the Banks.
Yeah, this year marks the 10-year anniversary of the groundbreaking at the Banks, 2008. And, you know, you look at where the Banks is today, half finished. The Chamber is bringing a large Ferris wheel, a sky wheel, so to speak, to the Banks. It's going to be 150 feet tall, which is 15 stories. There are 36 gondolas, each carrying up to 6 people. They've got 1 million LED lights on the wheel. It's kind of like the one that was at Coney Island earlier this year. It's going to be on that little piece of land just to the east of the Yard House, a little bit northeast of Carol Ann's Carousel, right south of the Freedom Center. It's going to be there until the 1st of December. And it opens next Friday.
And it's what? You get 4 rotations for $12.50?
Yeah, about
plus tax.
Yeah, 15 minutes or so.
I can't help but ask this question. I may get in trouble. Do the Bengals have veto power over a 15-story sky wheel?
I don't think
it's too far away, Jay.
Yeah, too far away.
They probably wish they did, though.
They made the announcement on the deck of the Freedom Center, and that's a nice view from up there, so you can imagine what 15 stories up is going to look like.
So this won't be competing with the Newport Skywheel at the half plan,
which has not yet been built.
Yeah, the one on the Cincinnati side will probably be gone before they...
Dueling Skywheels.
I would think so.
That would be interesting, though. Which Skywheel's better? Try both. It's our Friday News Review, and we will continue our conversation in just a moment. It's Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Jay Hanselman, filling in today for Dan Hurley. It's the Friday News Review. My guests are Cincinnati Enquirer Regional Government Reporter Scott Wortman, Cincinnati Business Courier staff reporter and columnist Chris Wetterich, and WVXU reporter Bill Reinhart. You can join the conversation. Our phone number is 513-419-7100, or email us at talk@wvxu.org. We're also on Facebook and Twitter, again, 513-419-7100. Bill, let's switch to you as we change topics here. Cincinnati and some townships in Hamilton County and the county commissioners themselves are a little upset about water rates. Tell us what's going on.
Well, a couple of weeks ago, this surfaced at county commission where...
Don't ever talk about me.
Sorry, pun wars. And what's happening is Cincinnati wants to charge some of the unincorporated areas of Hamilton County a little bit more for their water. Right now, those areas... It's a complicated formula, but basically, if a city resident pays one, a person in the unincorporated area would pay 1.25. So, you know, they're paying a little bit more.
They pay a quarter more, essentially, yeah, is on a dollar.
Exactly. And the proposal is to take that up to 1.43 per whatever. And the city says, well, we need that because of increasing costs. We've looked this over, and we really need to do it. And the county, townships have gone to the county and said, hey, whoa, wait a second. What's going on here? Well, the two sides, the city and the county, had agreed to start a board.
Task force.
Thank you. That's the word that I keep hearing and keep forgetting. Task force to look at an equitable way to charge people outside of the city for the city's water. Well, the county appointed its members to it, and the city took a little while but finally got around to it. And the task force has not finished its recommendations, but the city went ahead and said, yes, we're going to raise our rates. So people are going to the county commissioners because they're the ones who are represented by the county commissioners and saying, hey, what can you do?
Scott, you wrote about this too. Anything you want to add to that?
About
the water rates?
It's been a while, and it's a complex issue, but you're more up to speed on it than I am. I was trying to make it sound like I knew what I was talking about there. Couldn't pull it off. I tried.
I think it's worth noting on this, like, the city of Columbus, it's kind of a contrast between how the Cincinnati operates and Columbus operates. In Columbus, if you want the city's water there, you have to become a part of the city. In Cincinnati, they've been kind-hearted enough to sell their water to the suburbanites without making them come into the city.
So. Well, the city put out a memo. There's a couple things, and you were talking about the rate. This is not uncommon. Cincinnati is proposing 1.43. Toledo's is 1.75. Akron's is 1.6. Columbus is 1.5. And Cleveland is anywhere from 1.3 to 1.85. The city also said that they even bolded it in their memo from yesterday that it should be noted that in 2004, the city offered to extend the term of the 1987 county contract for additional 30 years at a rate equivalent to 1.25 times city water rates, and that was rejected. Hmm. And what about I know that the townships are complaining. The city says that for an average customer using basically about 4,500 gallons a month, this would mean like a $2.21 increase. I saw some news reports. There was one township trustee that was saying it could be anywhere from $40 to $50 a month. Do we know how to square that?
Well, it would be $40 to $50 a year. If it's $2 a month, it'd be $48
a
year.
That could be that I misread what...
Or maybe they misunderstood. It's all a matter of...
Oh, it didn't say. You're right. It didn't say monthly. It said $40 to $50 increase on my bill.
Yeah.
So that squares.
I did hear the dystopian scenario that one Anderson Township trustee said that, well, we might not be able to afford to fill Sunlight Pool. And so they're painting the oblique future with these water rates.
Based on the city memo, and they're laying out their facts and answering a number of questions, I'm also hearing... it sounds like this is going to be another piece of litigation between Cincinnati and Hamilton County. Not that that's uncommon.
No, not uncommon at all. To have the two sides squabbling over something, to have the two sides not squabbling over something would be news. The MSD thing, last year, if you'll remember, the City Council and County Commission met several times during the summer to figure out how the 1968 agreement over the operation of the Metropolitan Sewer District would come to an end, as the agreement ended this year in April. Well, they had an agreement. It rested on a couple of things that were – no one was quite sure if they were going to come to pass. For instance, the Ohio Public Employees Retirement System was going to have to sign off on something. The legislature was going to have to sign off on something. And this week we found out that OPERS, O-P-E-R-S, said, no, we're not interested. What that was as the control of MSD went to the county, current MSD employees would stay on the city's retirement system, and future MSD employees would stay on the Cincinnati retirement system to keep that pension system solvent. Well, OPERS said, no, we can't go with that. So we're going to have to watch and wait and see what happens, goes from here. No one's quite sure what's going to happen. And so we all wait.
You know, this is if the state of Ohio ever does the city of Cincinnati or the urban core here a favor, it'll be the first time. It was no surprise to me that the state, you know, turned its nose up at this thing, and you know, I think it's just going to lead to another couple years of disputes and litigation and negotiation. They're already sending memos back and forth about various things, and let's not forget that the next phase of the sewer overhaul is supposed to happen, or they were supposed to submit a plan to the EPA. Instead of submitting a joint plan, the city submitted its plan, and the county submitted its plan, and the EPA said, well, you're supposed to submit one plan. And so you can see the bureaucratic logjam, you know, happening again with this issue. It's been quiet for about a year, but I think it's going to be in the news from this point forward for a while.
I can imagine there's at least one city council member who said or former city council member who's saying, I told you so, about the retirement piece. Charlie Winburn was adamant that he voted to support the agreement, but he didn't think there was any way the state would ever approve the retirement piece.
And remember, Jay, there was such a hurry to pass this prior to the 2017 election. You know, it was, oh my gosh, we have a bond sale that we've got to do and this and that. And, you know, of course, all of that was kind of a smokescreen for trying to jam this through.
I think the person that's really in the hot seat on this on both sides of this is Judge Michael Barrett, the federal right. judge overseeing the consent decree for the Metropolitan Sewer District. He also happens to be the same federal judge who crafted the collaborative agreement or the master settlement of whatever you want to call it for the Cincinnati pension system. And he's got to be careful, because if he tries to fix one, he could vastly undo the other.
Right. I mean, he's in a tough spot here. And I think, you know, according to the law in this MSD case, he has to consider the law. He can't be thinking about what happens to the Cincinnati pension retirement system if he were to rule kind of more in favor of the county than the city. But that's obviously a huge obstacle for the city, because they've just fixed their pension system, quote unquote, fixed it. And if these employees ended up going to the county for whatever reason, that would be hugely harmful to the Cincinnati retirement system.
Bill, you interviewed Commissioner Monzel after this was announced. I think we decided it was on Monday. And he seemed to think that PERS, Public Employees Retirement System, was closer to his way of thinking, that current city employees would stay in the city retirement system. New MSD employees, if this transferred to the county, would go to OPERS.
Yeah, he says he was the only person on the city and for the county to vote against this last year, the one person out of all of those. And he's basically saying, yep, I knew this was going to happen. He says the path forward is to look at keeping current employees in the Cincinnati retirement system, but new future employees would be county employees, and they would be part of OPERS.
Let's also not forget the risks to the county here. The city's argument is basically, we built all these sewage treatment plants, and we allowed the county sewer system to use them. When the 50-year agreement expires, we get them back legally. And the county, of course, says that's bunk. But the city's argument hasn't really been tested in court at all. So the risk to the county is a judge could say, well, fine, you can have the sewage treatment plants, but you have to pay the city for them. And this county, of course, has no money for this. And these are tens of millions of dollars worth of assets, maybe more than that, depending on whether you count the lines under the streets and all that kind of stuff. So there's some risk to the county as well. And I think that both sides would be behooved if they get back to the negotiating table and try to figure this out.
Not that I'm trying to problem solve, but sitting here thinking about this, could the ultimate answer be, I think eventually as part of
city-county consolidation?
Well, but that's another point. But I think as part of the retirement settlement, eventually the plan was, Cincinnati is the only city in the state that has its own pension system.
Right.
And I think the ultimate goal would be for the city to get out of the pension business and transfer in to the OPERS system. Could it be such a way that the city, if the county helps to financially bring the city's pension system up to the point that OPERS would be willing to accept it and the problem could be solved?
That's interesting, Jay. You ought to work for the city or the county maybe. But no, I mean, I think the city would love to unload that pension system, and there's a few obstacles.
I think they'd love
it.
To unload MSD too.
Right. So there's, you know, the city benefits are a little different than OPERS, and the other issue is that the city system, and I just did an article about this last week, this week or something. Sometime recently I did an article on it, that the city's pension system is about 74 or 75% funded. I don't think there's any way OPERS would take it at that level.
I think the number was closer to 85 to 90% funded.
They would need to get to a much higher level than they are. And so, you know, perhaps there's a way to figure out how to do that.
And it's better. I mean, at one point it was down to, what, 62%?
Right. You know, in the pension deal from 2015, the city moved like more than $200 million from the healthcare side, which was flush with cash, to the pension side. And that really bolstered the whole thing and enabled the city to have a steady stream of payments to that when before the pension payment was threatening to really eat into basic services at the city.
513-419-7100. Rosemary, you're on the air. Go ahead with your question.
Yes, your discussion about the increase in the water rates in surrounding areas to Cincinnati, how is that going to influence our sewer rates? Because I understand the two rates are somehow tied together. The biggest part of our water bill isn't the water, it's the sewer rates.
Right.
So how is that going to be influenced?
I mean, it's basically two separate things on the same bill, more or less. The water rates and the sewer rates are decided separately. So if they increase the water rates, they're just increasing the water rates. When they increase the sewer rates, they're just increasing the sewer rates. But you're correct that most people get their water bill and they think a lot of it, you know, they think that their water rates are so high when really it's the sewer rates that have been going up and up over the years. So the water rates have as well. I mean, and the city council's voted to increase those many budgets now.
And I think right now where this stands, the 1968 agreement was extended through the end of September. So
right.
One would assume sometime between now and the end of September there'll be another extension.
One can assume a lot of things, Jay.
On that issue, you know, the county wants the judge to help them extend it, but the city has said, well, we want a couple of conditions on that.
And one of those, I think, is to end county monitoring.
Yeah. There's a consultant's
report that'll be the biggie.
That they have, yeah.
Which I thought was interesting. If I was reading the city's memo right on that, the consultant was actually hired by the county?
You know, that's what the city says. The consultant – so let me back up. So when they made this deal to merge or to basically turn over much of the control of the sewer district over to a board that would be mostly county appointed or that would kind of be tilted towards the county, the county hired a consultant – or the city and the county hired a consultant to help them work through these issues. The city says it's a county-hired consultant. On the consultant's report, which I read, it says the city and the county hired us, so whatever. But the upshot is the county consultant, the city county consultant, said basically that the county monitoring apparatus is really a management apparatus and really called into question the need for that. And the city has said, well, look, if we're going to extend this agreement past September, I don't think we need this thing. And you know, the county loves its monitor and wants to keep it. So
for all of us in the room, our three favorite letters of the alphabet will continue to be MSD. Scott, you had a story this week. I think the headline is, why is Hamilton County government so poor?
Yes.
Explain.
Well, pretty much every financial crisis in Hamilton County seems to go back to the stadiums. I know we talked a lot about that earlier, but this is no different. I mean, county government is basically just a big budget, and it's kind of a local arm of the state. And over the years, voters and county leaders have decided to devote a lot of the money to stadiums and part of the sales tax, also, which is the largest source of revenue for the county, goes to this. More money goes to the two stadiums on the riverfront and Union Terminal than goes to the rest of the county general fund, and that is a large reason why the county is facing a massive deficit for next year. Also, partly the state to balance its own budget has cut money to local governments. So that's why you'll be seeing a lot of cuts in the sheriff's department and a lot of other county services.
In the county, though, to me, I mean, Chris and I are familiar with the city, where the city council sets the budget and all the departments have to follow along. Mm-hmm. County is a little bit different. The county commissioners can propose a budget, but a lot of that is spent by independently elected office holders.
Yeah, the sheriff, the auditor, they pretty much control their departments, and who they hire and how much they spend. And if they come in over budget, then the county commissioners have to find it.
And the interesting one is the courts. If the judges don't like their budget, basically they can issue a court order that they're going to spend that much money.
It's really not a great system, because the county budget is basically – it's like a suggestion. In the city, it's not a suggestion. If you go over your budget, then you're cutting something. So, I mean, it's not a great system.
And a large part of the increased spending for the county is in courts and the sheriff and a lot of public safety and judicial spending. That's where the largest spike in the last couple of years has come from.
Yeah, one thing about the stadium thing, it's not like the county is sending money from the general fund to the stadium. It just happens to be using a lot of its tax authority for stadiums, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, do I understand?
Well, yeah. The state imposes a 5.75% sales tax and then allows by law counties to tack on an additional 1.5%. And most counties in Ohio do that, and it goes into the county services and general fund. But here in Hamilton County, only a half cent goes to the county government and services, and 0.75 cents goes to the stadiums.
And that's 50 cents for the stadium and 25 mm-hmm. cents for Union Terminal.
Yes.
Which will be coming off in
2020.
April 2020.
Bill, you look like you were going to say something.
No, they covered it.
And we're waiting for the county administrator to release. They had a budget proposal that included a sales tax increase. What was it, 0.2 cents? And they withdrew that. So now they're working on a budget that will include, is it 17% cuts across the board?
I think that's the maximum amount of cuts. It probably will end up being that. But they likened it to what happened in 2008 as the housing market crashed and revenues plummeted. You had a lot of sheriff's deputies that didn't get replaced. There was backlog on building permits. Only this time there's a lot less to cut. The county has 800 fewer employees than in 2008.
I talked to Commissioner Driehaus about that the other day, and I noted to her how often we see at the city these draconian deficit numbers and the budget cuts that will be made, and maybe there'll be a layoff here or there. And, of course, every year, Jay, as you know, there's money under the couch. Usually what they've done.
City has nicer furniture than the county.
Right. You know, in recent years, they've raised a bunch of fees to really cover the deficit. And so I said, is this going to end up being a cry wolf type of thing? And she said, no, the office holders are going to take these 17% cuts. I mean, they're going to try to preserve as much as they can, but this is for real, she said. So I'll be interested to see how that works.
You'll probably see some fees raised. For instance, the 911 dispatch fee. That's going to probably go up.
And they're hinting at probably in May they might do another push for a sales tax increase. So that's not
And would
in
this
the past.
Be one that they would try to impose themselves, or they just actually put it on the ballot?
I think they're looking at putting it on the ballot directly mm-hmm. this time.
Chris, speaking of taxes on the ballot, back in, June, there was a splashy press conference where Councilmember Sittenfeld, Mann, and Landsman rolled out this proposal to increase the city's admissions tax from 3% to 5%, put that on the ballot this fall as a charter amendment. And we learned this week that that's going nowhere.
No, it's dead for the year, and the reasons were kind of crazy when you think about it. Let's rewind for a moment to, I think it was it June?
I think it was June.
Yeah. So PG Sittenfeld and as you said, David Mann had this press conference. And
let's not leave out Greg Landsman. He was there.
He kind of showed up there, if I remember correctly.
But he was supportive.
Yeah, he stood back there but didn't really speak. I wasn't sure what Greg was doing, but he did say he was going to vote for it. Anyway, so they had this press conference that said, we're going to raise the emissions tax by 2 percentage points, and this is going to pay for human services, and we're not going to have these yearly budget battles over that anymore, and we're going to help neighborhoods out, and it's going to really be great. And I guess behind the scenes, the human services providers were, you know, told about 4 o'clock the day before that this thing was happening. And so they scrambled around and got approval from their boards to show up and endorse this thing. Well, lo and behold, in July, they were called into a meeting with council member Sittenfeld and told, you know, hey, look, can you guys run this campaign? And they were like, what are you talking about? We thought you were running it. We thought the elected officials were going to do it, and we would, of course, support it. And they said, well, no, we're not really going to do it that way. And so consequently, this was an army without a general, basically. And, you know, the months have passed by, and the deadline for putting this on the ballot is September. And so since nobody's going to lead it, that's not going to happen. And
is that surprising? Because, I mean, I have been to
not at all.
Tons of budget hearings in my lifetime. And when they mention a cut to human services, the supporters, even CEOs of these human service organizations, come out of the woodwork to talk about and lobby for that funding. And you would think it would be to their benefit to find a general to run this campaign.
Right, right. And I'm not really sure who's to blame, whether it's the human services or the politicians who got in over their skis on it. But I think it's just another example this year of kind of progressives in this city just kind of completely failing. You know, they talked a big game about the bus tax, and the business community was kind of on board with that to some extent, and that went by the wayside. The county sales tax went by the wayside. They're all betting big on you know, on this congressional race, and I think that almost above all is the main factor. Although in this case it was a city tax, but the Bengals and the Reds and the FC folks opposed it, and it sounded like they were going to spend money on it. And so they kind of got scared and said, okay, we're out.
And it's almost like one of those taxes that, yeah, it's there, but do people even know it? I mean, I think the last concert ticket I bought was to go see Garth Brooks a couple of years ago. I was going to go see Garth Brooks. I didn't think about, I know I'm going to pay fees over and above what the ticket cost. It's just there.
Yeah, the fee's not on the ticket. Like, you don't see it, right? It's in the ticket price, and it was really like $1.50 or something, and now it would go up 3 to 5% on a $50 ticket. It's a drop in the bucket. But the teams don't want the added cost.
Gentlemen, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, it's our Friday news review. My guests were Cincinnati Enquirer regional government reporter Scott Wortman, Cincinnati Business Courier staff reporter and columnist Chris Wetterich, and WVXU reporter Bill Reinhardt. Coming up after a short break, we'll talk about why Cincinnati continues to carry millions of dollars in loans and unpaid debt. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is 91.7 WVXU Cincinnati Edition. I'm Jay Hanselman filling in for Dan Hurley. It's our Friday news review. Channel 9 recently did a story that found developers, nonprofits, and even citizens owe the city of Cincinnati more than $2 million in overdue payments from commercial loans made during the past two decades. Joining me to discuss that report is WCPO reporter Paula Christian. You can join the conversation. The number is 513-419-7100 or email talk@wvxu.org. You'll also find us on Facebook and Twitter, 513-419-7100. Paula, thanks for being here.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So you did an extensive report, and what did you find?
Well, you know, you and I sit there at City Hall when they're debating the budget and, you know, bemoaning and crying that there's no money. And so I thought I would take a look at how many loans the city has on its books that are overdue, that are bad, that they're not getting paid back for. And I found quite a few. So this took several months to go through the list of loans and really dig into it. But basically, the city is owed $2.3 million in overdue payments from loans it's made mostly to commercial developers. And it's shouldering roughly $11 million in loans that are not current, which means they're either in collections for non-payment or being restructured, but they're not getting paid on.
And do we, I mean, normally when one wants a loan, they go to a bank. So do we know why the city basically became a bank, why were they loaning the money to start with?
Well, the city doesn't like to advertise that it's in this banking industry that it gives out loans. In fact, I think if you ask the average person, it would never occur to them to go to the city for a loan to develop a project. But they do. They tie them to neighborhoods they want to see development in, neighborhoods that need revitalization, minority business owners that they're trying to spur, new minority businesses. You know, they do give out these loans.
One that, and we'll talk about some of these, most of these are not recent loans.
No. Most of these, well, it's interesting. The city has made plenty of loans recently that are all good loans, but we won't know if they're bad yet for several years because payments aren't due yet. So that doesn't necessarily mean the city's doing a fantastic job now. It just means these projects aren't done and these loan payments aren't due yet.
How does the city fall? I mean, if you and I have a mortgage and we're not paying our mortgage at a certain point, our lender will start mailing us, usually certified letters, to make sure that we've got them to say, hey, you owe us. And then if you don't pay up, eventually it could end up in foreclosure. Does the city have any? Do they do anything like that?
Well, they do. I think one of the things that surprised me the most in doing this story was how the city can let these loans go on for 15, 20 years and not get repaid on them. It's really was shocking to me. But they do try and collect their money. It's just, it seems to me by the time they end up getting around to it, there's no money left. These people have either declared bankruptcy, the LLC's closed, they can't find these people, there's nothing left, there's no money to get back.
We had someone email that said the folks seeking these loans, if they had the collateral, they would go to a bank instead of the city.
Absolutely right.
To get the funding.
Yes, that's absolutely right. It's interesting. After this story ran, I had a former employee of city's Department of Community and Economic Development email me and extensively talked about these are people who can't get a loan from a bank that come to the city because they have no choice. It's either the city loans them the money or they can't do the project.
And who's approving these? Is this city staff or is this ultimately elected officials who allow this to go on?
Well, the big projects do come before city council for approval. But you and I have both heard, these development deals get dropped on the desks of city council literally minutes before they're supposed to vote on them. And we've heard Chris Seelbach in particular complain about this, that he's just not going to vote for these anymore until he knows more about them. But for example, there was a loan that city council approved 2 years ago. It was an acquisition loan to a Price Hill developer, KB Partners. And it was for $315,000 and it was an acquisition loan. And city council approved it. Well, KB Partners owned this property a year before. They already owned the property that they got the acquisition loan for. And in fact, they paid cash for it. So we never got an explanation from the city about why this loan was made. But if you're a city council person with this coming on your desk, it looks fine to me. And I mean, you vote for it.
One that you mentioned that either rightly or wrongly has gotten a lot of attention was the loan that the city extended to Liz Rogers for her to open Mahogany's at the banks. That is now closed. The city actually reached an agreement with her to settle for a lesser amount. So where does that stand on getting – is that being repaid or what's the process for trying to get it repaid?
Well, Liz Rogers received a $684,000 grant from the city and a $300,000 loan to help her with this restaurant. When things began to go south, former city manager Harry Black renegotiated that to just a $100,000 loan, something that he thought she'd be able to repay. So to date, he redid that 2.5 years ago. So to date, she has repaid $3,200 and she has repaid nothing since February 2016. The city did receive did get a judgment against her and has a it will get its money back when she has money to give back. But there's several other liens that are ahead of the city. And so the likelihood of the city recouping anything seems to be slim.
What As my understanding from your report, the city would not make anyone available to talk about this.
No. The city's Department of Economic Development declined our request for an interview, which was a little bit surprising because I am very rarely declined an interview. Always people like to say what their side of the story is. And I'm sure that there is a explanation for or at least a better way to explain how the city gives this money out, which we were not able to get because they would not give us an interview. They did answer some questions via email, but the answers were frankly, not as in-depth than I would have hoped.
You did talk to some other folks. I know one of the folks that you talked to was former council member Kevin Flynn. And
yes.
This was something that he talked about quite a bit when he was a council member.
Yes. He has always been harping on the city needs to be more fiscally responsible about what it does with its money. And if you're going to make loans, then draw up loan documents where people actually have skin in the game and the city has a better chance of being repaid. Don't make loans to LLCs where the people are going to disappear and the city's never going to get their money back. Or if the city is going to do that, then maybe it should call it what it is. Instead of a loan, it's a giveaway.
And you also talked to Jeff Capel, who was a fierce government watchdog of both the city and Hamilton County.
Yeah, well, he was in a tizzy about this story because he is another one who has been saying for a long time that the local government should not be in the business of giving out loans. And the reason is precisely that they almost never get paid back. So, for example, the city gave out a loan in 2013 to a small heating and air company for $230,000, I believe. A year later, this company and the owner went bankrupt. So I looked, and the city, of course, has never gotten their money back. So I looked in his bankruptcy filings for this company and this gentleman. And at the time the city gave the loan in 2013, this gentleman owed state and federal back taxes in excess of $27,000, where it was obvious if the city had done any checking whatsoever, they would know that that this person already was in deep debt, and why would they loan him this money?
Do we know, you talk about that they already have debt. Do we know, is there any underwriting? I mean, if you and I apply for, a loan, we have to go through, I always say that you have to fill out as many pieces of paper as the amount of money that you want to borrow. Is the underwriting there to check the credit worthiness of these folks that they're loaning money to?
Well, former Councilman Kevin Flynn insists that the most people at the city's Department of Economic Development don't have any banking experience. And, there has been a tremendous amount of turnover in that department. Since the department declined our request for an interview, I can't tell you if they have people there doing correct underwriting or not. The Department of Economic Development did say that they began a thorough review of the city's loans last year prior to WCPO asking questions, and that they are taking a much harder look at how the city loans money and to who. But, I think this whole thing goes in cycles. I'm not so sure anything in 5 years from now is really going to change.
In just about 10 seconds here before we wrap up, any follow-up that you plan to do now that you've had the initial report out there?
Well, myself and my colleague Hillary Lake, who worked on the story with me, we are going to be watching the deals that City Council approves this fall to developers, in particular to loans.
We've been discussing the millions of dollars Cincinnati is owed from loans and unpaid debt. My guest was WCPO reporter Paula Christian. Paula, thanks for being here.
Thanks very much, Jay.
And thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. The producer for today's show was Pete Reitmeier. Our assistant producer was Selena Reeder. Our segment producer is Layla Shakui. And our technical director was Dave Shermer. Archives of our programs are available on our website, WVXU.org. I'm Jay Hanselman filling in for Dan Hurley. Have a great weekend. Major giving campaigns with celebrity endorsements and live televised events have awakened us to many of the world's human rights struggles. But do they really translate into actions that get results? On the next Cincinnati edition, how innovative programs at the University of Dayton are working together to meet the challenge of strengthening human rights and sustainability efforts worldwide. Monday on Cincinnati Edition at 1 on 91.7 WVXU.